So again, hello everybody, and welcome to Masterclass this Thursday night, March 23rd, 2023. That was correct. So glad to have you. I know that you will enjoy it as I have enjoyed every Masterclass so far. We have some great speakers tonight, and including, as I said, Brandon Greer, Christopher Kimsey, and Joshua Rogers. So if Brandon, if you are ready, we can go ahead and get started.
All right, cool. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
All right, let me see if I can present this. All right, does everybody see my screen?
I do, yes.
Okay. All right, so good evening, everyone. My name is Brandon Greer, and today my topic is going to be about AI and supercomputers. So what is AI? What is a supercomputer? You know, you might be asking that. So AI, or artificial intelligence, is the simulation of human intelligence in machines that are programmed to think like humans and mimic their actions. Now, a supercomputer is simply the fastest computer in the world that can process a significant amount of data very quickly. So here we can see by Frankenfield, that's what he quoted, what AI is defined as, and Thacker, that's what they quote a supercomputer to be. So what exactly do these things do? Well, with AI, it learns how to operate based on what we give it. So if we give it a book to read or ask questions about what's happening in the book or what has happened to some of the main characters, we can expect output that might give us a summary of what happened, or we can ask direct questions about certain aspects of the book, right? So a prime example of AI that is buzzing the news right now is ChatGPT. We see users sending the AI things like explain the Big Bang Theory, or, you know, it will explain right out, like write me a resume if we want to ask that, and it would generate a resume for us to use and build for whatever circumstance that we have, as long as we provide it some type of information or some type of input. The main idea here is, as long as we give AI something to learn from, it will be able to generate some type of output or perform some type of task that we're trying to get it to perform. A supercomputer, on the other hand, it operates differently. So we often use supercomputers for intensive data and large computation-based research. There's usually a single problem we're trying to solve, and we develop a supercomputer to try to achieve our goal. Some examples of a supercomputer are things like the Deep Crack, which was used to brute force the DES, or data encryption standard. The main goal behind it was to prove that DES key size was not sufficient to be secure, and after 56 hours of Deep Crack attempting this brute force attempt, the machine achieved its goal. So we can see how powerful computers and supercomputers can be when we have a certain drive or some goal that we're trying to achieve. So why is it important to know this, right? So as we see, AI is becoming popular, and it's a known fact. We see with ChatGPT becoming a tool in everybody's hands, you know, all the time. I see it on things like Facebook or Instagram, someone creating some new ChatGPT or using ChatGPT to create some type of output that we're not used to seeing or haven't seen yet. So we can use this information to assess how can it also be used in the hands of attackers and malicious intent. We often see, you know, pop culture and movies like The Terminator, where AI becomes sentient and its goal is to hunt down humans and cause mass destruction. So we have to be really careful about how we manage these programs. So I pose a question, what happens if we were to run an AI on a supercomputer and merge these two concepts together, right? We can see that in our IDS, or intrusion detection systems, and IPS, intrusion prevention systems, or firewalls, they incorporate anomaly-based algorithms that are boosted by AI in order to help protect our information. So what happens if we instead use it for malicious intent? We're already using it for that defensive side. So What if we create an AI that runs off of these supercomputers whose only goal is to cause chaos through hacking, cracking, any other form of cyber attacking or cyber threats? Overall, it could be good or it could be bad. If we made an AI capable of these tools, if we had this concept and we try to make it as good as possible and use only for the good and betterment of the world, there would be virtually no need for any form of software security because this AI would be able to protect our devices from any and all attacks. It would have the tools needed to detect things like an IDS, prevent like an IPS, and summarize what happened, and we could act like it's just a normal day on the web. The fear of cyber criminals would go away because we know our AI is so strong and so fast at handling these potential attacks that there's no reason to have to worry about investing in products like McAfee or Malwarebytes, things like that, that already do these malware scanning and antivirus processes. So this sounds great. Great idea. Never have to worry about your information end up in someone else's hands, ever have to be attacked or hacked. But what happens instead if it's used for evil? Well, the moment the AI would be able to get inside of the network through any vulnerability, the ability to protect, safeguard, reverse the damage would be virtually impossible. We already know that there are polymorphic viruses out there that create modified versions of itself that avoid detection, yet they still continue the same path of attack. The issue is that it would know what every malware detection software ever invented is and how it prevents malware from getting onto the system and uses information to prevent itself from being detected by these applications. So who could ultimately stop these devices? If someone has created such a powerful AI, who can we lend on? Who can we, you know, go and talk to try to prevent this from happening or stop it? Well, there are many dark or anti-dark AI initiatives set in motion already. So here in a quote by Minovic, it states places like United Nations, World Economic Forum, the UNICRI, Center for AI and Robotics, the G2O and OECD in the White House. In addition, companies like Microsoft have helped mobilize the masses in a grassroots movement against dark artificial intelligence through a set of AI principles, which have been instrumental in defining a workplace code of conduct surrounding responsible AI. Chief among Microsoft's AI principles include fairness, reliability, safety, privacy and security, inclusiveness, transparency, and accountability. This just means that all these organizations are all putting forth effort to combat against this idea and how to properly respond to a potential threat. There are many different methods being used to combat against dark AI, like enforcing ethical codes and standards to the AI to prevent issues that we have already discussed. So how could we, the everyday citizen, step in to stop these, right? Well, a quote from Selmer Bringsjord from the article Protect the Future, How to Stop AI from Overpowering Humanity, gives a frightening statement. AI that merely approaches human-level intelligence and is both autonomous and kinetically powerful would be enough to end humanity. Right? Terminator. Already. Very scary thought. But at the end of the day, the only real way to stop these malicious AI and dark AI would be pulling the plug. If we completely stop the AI in its tracks, turning off the systems and devices, and prevent it from ever getting to this point of sentient domination, then we could potentially stop this AI takeover. Banning the use, creation, and implementation of AI is the other way to stop it. If we ban it and actively prevent people from creating and using AI, then we could potentially stop the AI. Right now, the main source for prevention is to create rules, ethics, a framework for the AI to follow in the regulatory sense, but this is not a be-all solution to stopping AI from going out troll. Again, if we have a malicious attacker or someone who doesn't establish these frameworks or rules and ethics, then how is it going to stop the AI? They have no rules. They have no care. You know, it's what we feed into the AI is what we get out of the AI. So overall, in summary, right, When you're using AI with a supercomputer and teaching it how to use hacking toolkits and ideologies in order to hack the world is a reality that I hope to never experience. But the possibility of it happening is real. The use of AI and supercomputer collaboration is already being used. AI and supercomputers are starting to go hand in hand with one another already. Sorry about that. We the people have the power to stop AI and to control how it is used and implemented in our everyday applications. Things like Facebook or Google are still under federal laws that mandate how these companies use their technology and prevent them from taking advantage of their users. Now, real question is, are we there yet technically? Well, maybe. There's no true answer to this because, as far as we see, sometimes, yeah, we do use things like IDS and IPS that have some type of AI automated system to prevent and protect us. And then we have polymorphic viruses that we give code to that automatically do and follow that path of attack, right? So as we grow with AI, so does AI grow with us. Learning how to use AI and how they function and how to control AI is all available a click away on the web. It only takes having that information going to the wrong hands for things to go from bad to worse. So these are some of the references that I use. I mentioned them some in my PowerPoint, but that is it. Hope you guys enjoyed.
Excellent job. Thank you for that information. Like I said, I always get some great information out of you guys. So now you help me with AI so much. And yes, ChatGPT is one of our issues with the school, with PG. But we're back and forth on that, right? So this was great. This was very helpful. Hope everybody else enjoyed as much as I did. That was good. Thank you so much. Okay, next. Chris Kinsey, he's going to cover AWS Cloud Practitioner Certification, which I'm still supposed to get completed. So maybe you can give me some tips.
Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yes,
there we go. All right. Hi. How is everybody? How do I follow that? That was an awesome presentation. Mm-hmm. That was really good. I got to say, I have used ChatGPT a bit. Not for school. But I have used it to help polish up my resume and whatnot, just to kind of wordsmith some things. And it is scary. It's pretty scary how just intelligent it is. Yeah. But I'm going to cover the AWS Cloud Practitioner Certification today. Not as in-depth as our previous presentation, but it's really just what I want to cover is not so much the weeds of the cloud practitioner sort of stuff. I just kind of want to go over more about, is this a certification you should pursue? Is this, could this benefit you, right? Some of you that are probably working on your master's, finishing up your master's, this might not be for you, but it is something to consider. There might be reasons why you might want to consider it. I'm finishing up my associates, so this is a good one for me because it helps me in the long run. Right, so let's go to our next slide. This is just an overview. I'm going to talk about how I ended up getting into this cert, and maybe some of you guys can relate to that. I'm going to cover some training, kind of what to expect with the training modules, some of the benefits of pursuing this cert, and then just an exam overview, some of the details on how to take the cert. All right, so how did I get here? Let me see if I can blow this up a little bit. I have been working in IT for about 4 years. I worked in intelligence for probably over a decade before that. I've since going into IT, I've just taken a real strong interest in anything cloud related. So I've wanted to work doing something cloud, being in that world. And I just haven't been able to kind of get a job in it. So we started the internship here, and I was talking with Christy, and she's asking, what are you into? What do you want to pursue? What sort of, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I'm really interested in cloud stuff. And she said, all right, I got some stuff. I'll assign the AWS Cloud Practitioner materials for you and some Microsoft Azure stuff and get you going on that. So in that same week, I had just put my new sexy resume out to the world, and I got a few bites on it. But here's one of the bites that I got that was pretty off-putting, honestly. And I'm just going to – I can't really see it on my screen. So, oops. Let me see if I can see this a little bit better. No, I can't. Basically, you guys can probably read it better than me, but I got an email saying, hey, you applied for this. Do you have AWS experience? And before I even had a chance to reply, the CEO jumped in and was like, hey, you know, we need someone with AWS knowledge. I don't know if you guys can see it, but it's a bit catty. So I was a bit off put by that, but I did reply to them. I said, you know, I've done heaps of hours on A Cloud Guru and Linux Academy and so on and so forth. And they never responded, which is fine by me. But it did say that all right, if I don't have any experience working with AWS, I should at least try and pursue the certs and have something to say that, right? So it was a good kick in the butt to pursue the AWS Cloud Practitioner Cert. All right, so next up we have kind of what's covered in this. So these two, you know, left and right, those are both tasks that you can pursue in the internship here. And they cover, it's a bit of an umbrella of everything AWS, right? It's much like the if anybody's done the CompTIA A+ certification, you know, that the A+ certification kind of covers all things IT, right? And it kind of lets you figure out what you like and what you don't like, what areas you want to go into. So as you can see here, this covers networking, it covers storage, it covers security, monitoring, pricing, all the things, right? So, and it actually does cover a lot more than I expected. So after I got the certification, I posted it on LinkedIn and posted it on Facebook. And one of my friends jumped in and went, oh, cool, now you understand how AWS pricing works. And I went, yeah, nice joke, but it's a lot more than that. It covers a lot of stuff. So the nice thing with this too is I got the little bullet down on the bottom there. A lot of this training will roll into the more advanced training. So I started working on the security training after I finished this certification, and I was about 30% complete with it. So everything kind of builds on each other. Right. So next up, I'm just going to give you a few practice questions here. And that way you can kind of see what the test looks like. I know we're not going into any of the material, but it'll give you an idea of how straightforward the test is, or I don't want to say straightforward because they do have a few gotchas in there, but it'll give you an idea of what the test kind of will look like. These are practice test examples. So I didn't take anything from the actual exam, right? So here's your first one. It's a multiple choice question. They like to do this thing where there's two answers that are just going to be completely not close, and then there's going to be two that are, both of them might work, but they're really wanting one that makes the most sense. So they'll say, what is the most cost-effective answer, or what is the most efficient answer? So you need to kind of be aware of that. So this one here, I'll let you guys, you guys can answer this in chat, or if you want to use audio or however, or just take a guess. So why is AWS more economical than traditional data centers for applications with varying compute workloads? So just taking a guess. Yep. Perfect. Put your guess in the chat if you want. So this is one where it's got kind of a gotcha. It's asking what's more economical. Mm-hmm. So let's see. Amazon EC2 costs are billed on a monthly basis. It kind of feels related. B, users retain full administrative access to their Amazon EC2 instances. Next one, Amazon EC2 instances. You guys already got it. All right. So you can see some of them are pretty straightforward. So yeah, C is your answer. The ability to launch instances on demand when needed allows users to launch and terminate instances in response to a varying workload. This is more economical. This is a more economical practice than purchasing enough on-premises servers to handle the peak load. Now, nice. So for those of you guys that have worked with data centers, I work with, I've worked in some pretty big data centers where I'm located, and I'm watching them clear out. I'm watching them empty out, and I'm seeing that they are becoming big empty space as everything goes from bare metal to virtualized. So this is something that's a bit of awakening for me, going, oh, you know, everybody's moving to the cloud. Everybody's moving to AWS or Microsoft Azure or Google Cloud. So it's a good thing to have in the back of your head, because, you know, when you get that manager that's going, let's implement this giant system and we're going to build a data center, you can go, hang on a second, I've got a better solution for you. All right, here's the next question. Which of the following is an AWS responsibility under the AWS shared responsibilities model? So I'm going to talk on this. One of the big things they start you off with is AWS is responsible for security of the cloud, keyword of, and you are responsible for security in the cloud, keyword in, right? So let's see, what are our answers? Configuring third-party applications, maintaining physical hardware, securing application access and data. I live in Australia, so they say data here. Managing guest operating systems. So take a guess at that. So this one can be, for me, I was tempted to say managing guest operating systems when I was starting out, because you think they're covering, right? That's something they might cover, but they don't actually care what operating system you're running underneath, Linux, Windows, so on and so forth, or Linux distributions, I mean. So let's see here, what's our next one? Yep, maintaining the physical hardware, right? So maintaining physical hardware is an AWS responsibility under the AWS shared responsibility model. All the rest of that, I'm gonna go back to that. All the rest of that you manage. So third-party applications, that's something you cover. Amazon, AWS has over 200 services, but they also encourage you to reach out and use third-party applications, because there's some things that they're just not going to do for you. So they encourage you to use third-party applications. Securing applications, access, and data, that goes on you and your security team, right? But they do have their own sort of side to security stuff. So they do talk a lot about encryption, data in transit and data at rest, and encrypting everything all along the way and encouraging you to encrypt it as well. So it gets, you know, double encrypted, right? You can never be too safe with this stuff. All right. Next question. And I only have three questions here. So just to give you an idea of what the test looks like. How would a system administrator add an additional layer of login security to a user's AWS management console? So this one's got a little bit of a gotcha in it. So first answer, use Amazon Cloud Directory, audit AWS identity and access management roles, enable multi-factor authentication, and enable AWS CloudTrail. So I'm going to talk a little bit on each of these. You guys go ahead and take a guess. Another thing you'll notice on the exam is in the material, they're going to cover the main services. And if you see a service that they talk about on the exam that you didn't really cover, it's probably not going to be the answer. If you're like, I don't really know anything about that one, it's probably not the answer. So use Amazon Cloud Directory, right? That's not really a service that they talk about that much in the practitioner material. So avoid it. All right, the next one, audit AWS identity and access management roles. Right, that does sound good. It does sound like an additional layer of security. But look at the keyword there, audit. That's your gotcha. We're not talking about auditing, right? All of us are probably familiar with AIM, right? So my first guess, just glossing over it, I would have gone, AIM. But the keyword there is auditing. So they trick you there. Next one, enable multi-factor authentication. That's something we deal with everywhere, right? It does my head in, honestly, because I can't have my phone at work. So anytime I need to log into something, I have to run out to my car, get the little car off my phone and run back in, and hopefully I made it in time, right? So I love MFA, but I also just, it drives me nuts. All right, and then the last one, enable AWS CloudTrail. So AWS CloudTrail is the sort of their sexy name for your log files. Any sort of action taken within your EC2 instance or your any of your services, CloudTrail logs it. It's just your log files. So it's not really adding an additional layer of security for the login. It's just saying what you did. So this one is talking more user specific. So your answer is going to be enable multi-factor authentication. So multi-factor authentication, MFA, is a simple best practice that adds an extra layer of protection on top of a username and password. With MFA enabled, when a user signs into an AWS management console, they will be prompted for their username and password. The first factor, what they know, as well as for an authentication code from their MFA device. The second factor, what they have. And this could be your phone. This could be, I think they do security tokens. I know for some stuff I have like an RSA security token. Taken together, these multiple factors provide increased security for AWS account settings and resources. All right, I think that was the last question here. Okay, and then I'm just going to go into a few benefits of this certification. Like I talked about earlier, it could be a foot in the door with some cloud jobs. I won't say that, you know, applying for jobs, you're going to go, oh man, this person's got the AWS Cloud Practitioner certification. But it does give them a better idea that you are interested in cloud technology and you are trying to get in the door. It might get you an entry level position, but it's a stepping stone to higher level certifications. So I'll say with this, looking here, you've got sort of the different ways you should go. I jumped from the AWS Cloud Practitioner cert to working on the security cert. And I went, whoa, I understand the material, but the practice questions are just so over my head. If anybody in here has done Security Plus, it's very similar to that, where it's a lot of hypotheticals, a lot of situation-based questions. And I just was not ready for that. So I said, you know what, I'm going to hold off on doing this certification, and I'm going to kind of dig into some of the other stuff. And then I learned, too, that you're supposed to do the Solutions Architect Associate before kind of digging into any of those specialty certs. So I started working on that, and it's actually really helped me understand the security stuff a lot better. And I've also started working on the networking one. So I'm doing those kind of in parallel. And so I think just opening those up after the cloud practitioner stuff, I was about 30% done on those. So it wasn't like I was starting from scratch, which was really nice. That was another thing I was going to mention. The AWS cloud practitioner material, I'd say in this internship, I think it took me about 2 weeks to get through, 2.5 weeks to get through. And I think by the end of the second week, I registered for the exam and I took the test and had it. I passed the exam. Like, I think I had it all wrapped up in 3 or 4 weeks. So it's a pretty quick one to get. And this is kind of why I'm saying, like, this is a good one to pursue, because it's a pretty easy one to grab up, and it gives you an idea of all things cloud. All right, so here's another benefit, and this is more Purdue specific. So with this certification, once you get the cert, you can turn it in to the school, and it will actually take these three classes off your degree plan. So for me, that's 30 weeks that I don't need to do stuff. So I wouldn't mind pursuing the cloud. What is it? The cloud solutions and what's the bachelor's? You know the one I'm talking about. It's the cloud one. So this knocks out a few classes off of that. For those of you working on your master's, this might not help you, but there's that 500 level class in there. This one will only go towards the concentration on AWS stuff. So probably not going to help our master's level students, but for those of you like me who are working on associates, bachelor level stuff, there's two classes that you got taken care of, right? I was going to say anything else on that. Okay. Overview on this. So it's a foundational level. It's 90 minutes. I felt like 90 minutes was adequate. Materials for certification. Yeah, sorry, I didn't put that in here. I'll mention that in just a moment. So I did feel the certification was enough time. It gave me enough time to answer all the questions and then go back through and review stuff. I would have probably liked 10 or 20 more minutes just to kind of really look at things, but 90 minutes was good. $100 US, I think I paid for it in Australian dollars, and it's like still like 140 or 160. That's still pretty cheap for a cert, and that'll pay for itself. You know, you'll get that money back with like a lot of certs. And then 65 questions. I don't remember if mine was 65 questions. I think it might have been less, but some of those questions were multiple answer questions. So you'll get some that have two or three sort of, you know, pick two, pick three. The issue with those is if you get one wrong, in that you get the whole question wrong. So you'll actually get docked like 3 points. So just be mindful of those. But there's not my experience, I didn't have a lot of those. So, and then the delivery method is through Pearson View or through online proctoring. I actually, at my work, I do have a Pearson View test center, and I've used it plenty of times, but I actually much prefer, like, post-COVID 2020 madness, I actually prefer doing these exams at home, where I can sit in my comfortable bed and, you know, just be less stressed, right? So they do give you the options of doing that. And just quick review, and I'll get to the questions here in just a second. So, yep, that covers all of it. So we covered how I kind of got into this and maybe why you might want to pursue it. We covered the training, we covered the benefits, and the exam overview. So any questions? So I had to put this meme in here because I was looking for Purdue images. And this popped up and I thought it was hilarious. So I had to add this picture for you guys. You asked about You asked about the training materials. So if you're doing the internship, you can be assigned the training materials, and there's a link in there that'll take you straight to AWS. All the training materials, or a lot of the training materials, are free on the AWS. It's like their training center. It's pretty easy to Google. It's like the first thing that comes up when you Google like AWS training. There is stuff that you can do that is like, it is paid for, a few things that are paid for, but honestly, I've gotten through a bulk of the material, or like all the material, without paying for it. So, And there's a lot of free content that AWS just gives out. So I think they really encourage people to learn their stuff. And they also have a one-year free trial where you can go in and test stuff and break stuff. And I have a fear of, with the AWS stuff, of accidentally leaving an EC2 instance running or something and getting a massive bill. So yeah, free knowledge. Yeah. So they do give you a free year to just figure it out. So it's something to look into. Any other questions?
No questions, right. Just a big time appreciation. No questions, just a big time appreciation from someone that not in the department where a lot of certifications matter, but someone that's looking to grab at least the developers. I'm looking at the developers and the practitioners certifications just to have, because at least one or two of the companies I'm looking at are looking for like that high level overview, and they don't need to ask the question if I have the certification.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, is this is a good certification. What's that?
It sets you apart.
Yeah, it does. And this is the thing too, with this certification, it's a good one for managers to even take. That way you can speak, move your team to the cloud. This is a good one for managers to do because it gives you a general idea of what you're in for. Oh, watch your hours when using the free tier. Yeah, yep. I can see that there's a catch to it. All right, that concludes my masterclass.
Great job.
I don't actually know how to start.
That was
thanks.
Great stuff. Definitely. It helps to see it. Cool, it helps you. To see what you guys have learned, you know?
Yeah. I don't actually know how to end my PowerPoint.
You can go up to the share and click that, and it'll just stop sharing. So when you, and I think you hit escape on your keyboard, you can get out of the PowerPoint.
Oh, stop sharing. There we go. This is my first time.
No problem.
Doing this. So
pretty right. Cool. Yeah. Okay. Last but not least, we've got Joshua Rogers. Deep dive into data lakes.
Yeah.
What's a data lake? I guess you're gonna explain that.
Yeah, we'll talk about it a little bit for sure. It's just an unfathomable concept almost to me, at least it was previously. So I will share my screen if I can figure out where it is. That looks right. Everyone can see that okay, presumably.
Very good. I can, yes.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So I will go ahead and jump right in then, as it were. We're going to have a lot of water puns today. So not a lot, but enough for me. So we'll jump right in. If I can click the arrow key on the right application. So the first thing we need to talk about is big data, as data lakes are a part of big data. And so we can't talk about data lakes without talking about big data first. And big data is all about vast amounts of information that just continues to grow and grow. It refers to the volume of information, the speed or velocity at which it was created or gathered, and additionally, the different varieties of data points that are included. These Vs that have been cleverly slipped in are referred to as the three Vs of big data. And so as we're talking about collecting data, gathering data, we have to talk about where we're going to put it all. And there are several formats you can put them in, and each have their own purpose, based on the amount of data that you're working with and what you want to do with it. So first, we have our databases, which we're all pretty familiar with. These are great for small transactional data and can handle a lot of users. SQL is going to be your best friend here, and it can do some great reporting. Beyond that, we have our data warehouses. Now, these are meant for more analytics than queries. You can still run them, and SQL still works pretty well with it, but it's not meant for a lot of users. This is meant for more specialized people to have access to and to really run these analytical reports for your organization. So the analytics that they can perform are not really like normal querying and are much more powerful, and which is useful if you're trying to keep your transactional data separate from your analytical data. This leads us to data lakes. These are large bodies of data and are meant to receive data of all types. So relational, non-relational, mobile applications, websites, social media, corporate applications, just to name a few. And the divers for this metaphorical body of water include like data scientists and data engineers, business analysts who like to, although they generally like to stick to their curated data. I'll cover that a little bit more in a bit. Next slide, please. Slide mover. Okay. So what is a data lake? So what exactly is a data lake? Basically, this is a repository that is centralized and can accept any amount of data of any kind, structured or unstructured. And you can even run many varieties of analytics on that data in the form of machine learning, data movement, and visualizations. One particular Aberdeen survey even made note that companies that utilized data lakes were 9% more productive in their revenue growth. This is because data lakes give these companies a great place to start, and that is a vast amount of collected data from their customers, their own business, and everything else that might affect them. But more than having the data, it's tantamount to be able to analyze the data and figure out what to do with it so that you and your company can see that 9% plus growth. You can't just have it. You have to like figure out what to do with it and figure out why it matters to you. So now, data warehouses are wonderful, and they take that nice relational data, and it's suitable to SQL queries, and they give us even higher specialized function analyzing data. I mentioned that earlier. But data lakes have this ability, and they have the ability to receive data that is not necessarily neatly packaged in a relational database. It can take data from all kinds of social media, Internet of Things devices, applications, and business applications as well. So like more internal ones. So for instance, I have this friend, he's a data engineer for a major entertainment company. He told me how they put out a preview to this movie, and it was not particularly well received. Then his team, then he was put on a team that was able to mine a lot of data into their data lake. And they found, with that feedback and data, they found where that disconnect was, and they were able to change some things and make some updates. And so when they released a future trailer, it was much more well received, and the movie ended up doing pretty well. So I thought that was a really cool example of how data lakes and data engineers and data scientists use this vast amount of data that is just out there to turn things around. So I like to share that example. So how would you swim in a data lake? Well, while I myself am a big fan of swimming in general, the swimming that I mean to talk about here is, how do we tread this large amount of data, analyze and visualize it? How can we make this work for my company? Well, this is where data scientists and data engineers and business analysts really shine. Data scientists are masters at being able to gather and clean up the data that is in the lake, determine what to do with it using analytics, and present it in a way that is useful for business. This kind of feels a little bit like a consulting role, in that they take the data and present it and make recommendations based on their findings. Data engineers manage the data itself, which can be ever-changing. So they're that first line of touching the data that is being brought in and manage it. And they also validate it, organize it, and transfer it to the scientists and analysts so that they can more effectively do their jobs. And they're also in charge of securing the data and the security policies that are being followed for those that are accessing it. And then the business analysts, they're all about finding out, what are those questions that are coming up from the top of the organizations? What are the questions that matter to the business that we are using this data to solve or to make better, so that we can make this data mean something? This role helps focus the results and the queries that we look for. So to do all of this, these roles use programming skills such as Python and R and Java, frameworks such as Dask and Hadoop, and NoSQL databases as well. Excuse me. Beyond this, they need to have strong presentation and storytelling skills, visualization skills, and statistical and mathematical skills. We use those frameworks and programming skills to mine and clean the data, sure, but these other skills, some of which are soft skills, are important in conveying this data and making it matter for the business at hand. It is these soft skills and presentation skills that take the hard work of all the other roles and show what is really going on and what really matters here. And so I will move on to my next slide, where we talk about those soft skills and presenting the data lake. So unfortunately, I don't have a real fun water analogy for this particular one, but I find them very important anyway. Mining and cleaning the data means nothing if we can't make it serve us and guide our organization's decision making. That's the whole point. We do this by using mathematics and statistics, but also it's really important how you present it. Your presentation skills do start with some visualizations, but they should be impactful and only illustrate the words that you are saying. This means that taking time to come up with a script for the message you are trying to get across and keeping it concise as to not to add in too much information or confusion. This will also build your confidence. Knowing exactly what you're going to say and when you're going to say it and why it matters will innately help sell the idea that you are setting forth. If you aren't confident in your data, why should they be? Additionally, there are some soft skills at play, which include but are not limited to, like knowing the people that you're presenting to, reading the room in terms of mood, and being aware of how you look, not just how you're dressed, but how you are being perceived by those watching you. Are you smiling, or do you just think you're smiling, right? It's also about punctuality and respecting the time of the people that you are presenting to, which can even mean getting there a little bit early to check your audiovisual setup for presentation. Sometimes these kinds of things can be more conversational too. So especially in a smaller setting, it's important to have strong emotional intelligence and interpersonal skills. The final point I will make here is storytelling, which I mentioned earlier, I believe. The story that you're telling is that of the company this data that you're presenting and how it can change the outcome of the future and make things better, or even just be a warning sign for the path that we are currently on. Regardless of all these skills are equally as important as the technical skills. That's all I have. I do appreciate your time. Just what questions do we have as we have reached the end of my presentation? Cool. I just think data lakes are real interesting. Big data in general, I find very interesting. I was in a forum the other day with some people, and someone was talking about moving many dozens of petabytes worth of data and moving it and treating it. And just that is unfathomable to me. So I just thought it was cool. And I thought that I would bring a little bit of that to this meeting today. Thank you for your time.
I think there's a lot of people. That was a great job. Really.
Thank
it was.
You.
I think there's a lot of people don't realize how much data is actually taking and used. You know what I mean? It's so easy for them to get data from us that we don't even notice. Big
it's
data
real scary.
Is one of the biggest. It is really scary. But it is used for a lot of good too. I mean, you know, we use data for our own marketing and different things like that. So, you know, it does help businesses and whatnot, but it'd be good and bad. But that was a great presentation. Absolutely. Does anybody have any questions for any of our speakers this evening? Going through, and you might have come up with something. Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us.
Nope.
I hope you enjoyed everybody's presentations this evening. And have a wonderful day. What's today? Thursday. So have a wonderful day tomorrow. Be safe and have a great weekend. And have a great rest of the evening. Good night, everybody.
Thank you so much. Take care. Have a good night, everyone.
Thanks. Good night.
Good night, everyone.